Now, shortly before, about 5 days or so before the article that Dave just read about the 18 defendants being found guilty in that particular Pizza Connection case, something interesting happened in the life of Donald Regan, the former capo di tutti capo of Merrill Lynch, Pierce Finner and Smith.
It should be noted, too, that this is roughly 3 weeks after Carlos Leder Rivas, the Nazi leftist, quote-unquote, who was involved with the, allegedly with the Sandinistas, certainly with the Medellin cartel. This is about 3 weeks after his extradition.
That's right. And this is from the San Jose Mercury News for Saturday, February 28th, 1987. The headline, Baker appointed chief of staff. The subheadline, President reportedly didn't tell Regan. An article by David Hess and Ken Fireman of the Mercury Washington Bureau. President Reagan, in a move to repair his seriously damaged presidency, Friday appointed former Senate Majority Leader Howard Baker as his new chief of staff to replace the embattled Donald T. Regan. Regan, who had sought to hold on as chief of staff for at least another week, learned late in the afternoon that he had been replaced when National Security Advisor Frank Carlucci rushed into his office to tell him that Baker's appointment had been announced on network television. Excuse me, sources told the Washington Post. One source said that Regan, quote, blew a fuse at the news, had a one-sentence letter of resignation typed out, and, quote, stormed out of the White House. So Donald Regan, as we mentioned, one time head of Merrill Lynch, Pierce Fenner, and Smith, were in fact, when he was nominated initially as Secretary of Treasury, there were questions already that he had been involved in promoting some illegal tax straddle schemes of a variety of sorts, but was also in top man at Merrill Lynch at the time that some of this money laundering from the Pizza Connection scheme was going on. Later left the Treasury and became Ronald Reagan's chief of staff, where he was apparently one of the major focal points of the Contra funding network and one of the major interfaces between the White House and the rest of the scam. Donald Regan was removed rather precipitously, while there was a great deal of public foo-for-all about how Nancy Reagan was out to get him. But again, the timing of his removal is rather interesting.
Again, about 3 weeks after Carlos Leder Rivas is extradited, bear in mind that his connections with the Medellin cartel's connections to the Contra supply effort in Southern Air, and also, of course, to the Washington pizza case. And interestingly enough, about 2 weeks before Donald Regan resigned or was fired as White House Chief of Staff, there was an interesting change in the career of Scott Pierce, the former head of E.F. Hutton's brokerage outfit. Research credit for this also goes to Mae Russell. This is from the Wall Street Journal of February 11th, 1987. It's by Steve Swartz, SWARTZ, a journal reporter. Headlined, Hutton Group's Scott Pierce quits as vice chairman, State Line, New York. Scott Pierce, vice chairman of E.F. Hutton Group Incorporated, resigned unexpectedly. Mr. Pierce said in an interview that he decided to leave the securities firm because a management reorganization headed by Robert P. Ritterizer, R-I-T-T-E-R-E-I-S-E-R, chief executive officer, limited his role. Mr. Pierce said he isn't sure about his future plans. Mr. Ritterizer couldn't be reached for comment on Mr. Pierce's resignation. Mr. Pierce, 56 years old, said he was, quote, too young to be the senior statesman, unquote, which he said is what my future was if I decided to stay at the investment banking and brokerage firm, unquote. As vice chairman, he had been in charge of strategic planning and human resources. But strategic planning has increasingly come under the governorship of Mr. Ritterizer, who came to Hutton as president in 1985 from, and listen to this carefully, Merrill Lynch and Company in the wake of Hutton's check-kiting scandal. In May of 1985, Hutton pleaded guilty to 2,000 counts of mail and wire fraud in connection with a bank overdrafting scheme. Skipping down on the story, Mr. Pierce, who has been with Hutton for 11 years, lost his post as president of the E.F. Hutton and Company brokerage subsidiary to Mr. Ritterizer in January of 1986. Mr. Pierce was named vice chairman of the parent company at that time. So his vice chairmanship of the parent company was resigned on February 11th, a couple of weeks before Don Regan bows out, a week after Carlos Leder Rivas comes into the country. And again, bearing in mind the Merrill Lynch and E.F. Hutton connections to the heroin pizza case, the Gambino pizza case in New York, this is one of the reasons why we're asking the question concerning the Pizza Connection case in Washington, D.C., the Medellin-connected case. And again, Scott Pierce, George Bush's brother-in-law, Donald Regan, obviously White House Chief of Staff, and their resignations at this time are worth taking note of.
a lot of times people who are dealing with the kind of information that Dave and I talk about for the first time say things like, well, if all this is true, why doesn't anybody do anything about these things? Why don't these things come out in Congress? Well, in a larger sense, we're seeing tonight a lot of the stories that are perfectly newsworthy front-page items in major American newspapers that haven't surfaced in the Iran-Contragate hearings at all. But even in the more microcosmic sense, we're going to look at a particular case where they did have a probe, they did have an investigation, and son of a gun, one of the most important factors of all seemed to just drop right through the cracks and disappear. This is another article provided by Mae Russell. It was originally published in the Washington Post for January 27, 1987. The headline is, Hutton Probe Missed D.C. Branch by, quote, oversight, unquote. The article is by Morton Mintz, Washington Post staff writer. Former Attorney General Griffin B. Bell, who investigated illegal cash management practices at E.F. Hutton & Company, has testified that he did not cite the activities of Hutton & Company's branch at 1825 I Street Northwest, that's in Washington, because of, quote, an oversight. The branch accounted for 97 of the 2,000 felony counts of mail and wire fraud to which Hutton pleaded guilty in May of 85. Quote, can you explain why the particular branch was exonerated? Bell was asked during a deposition on January 8th and 9th. It was an oversight, unquote, he replied. A few days after the guilty plea, Chairman Robert M. Foreman hired Bell and Atlanta-based King & Spalding to review how the illegal practices evolved and to, quote, identify those individuals who bear personal responsibility, officers or employees. Bell, whose firm was paid $2.5 million for the probe, released his report in September of 1985. A year ago, former Bethesda branch manager John M. Pierce sued Hutton and Bell for alleged defamation and invasion of privacy. His suit seeks both compensatory and punitive damages. In a pretrial brief filed Friday, Pierce's lawyer said Bell attributed criminal responsibility to Pierce and called this, quote, false and irresponsible. The brief also alleges that Bell engaged in, quote, malicious and knowing defamation of Pierce. The brief alleges that Hutton's purpose in hiring Bell was to persuade the public and securities regulators that the abuses were, quote, the creation of local branch managers and other low-level employees, although, quote, the program was initiated, encouraged, and administered by senior corporate officers, unquote. Bell and Hutton have denied all such allegations. The brief included 16 pages of deposition excerpts that Pierce's lawyers, Stephen G. Milliken and Greta C. Van Susteren, said show Bell's, quote, lack of investigation, his purposeful limitation of inquiry to protect his client, and his reckless disregard of facts and plaintiff's rights, unquote. The excerpts show Bell repeatedly answering questions by saying that he was unfamiliar with or did not understand or remember key aspects of Hutton's cash management practices, but that he was confident his investigating team had most of the answers. At one point, Bell was asked whether a certain memo embraced, quote, overdrafting as we understand it to mean. He replied, quote, I don't know, just use the word overdraft, whatever that means, unquote. Bell acknowledged that just as Hutton had obtained interest-free bank loans by overdrafts of its branches, so had it received the equivalent by overdrawing the national account. Bell was asked about a November 1981 letter in which manufacturer's Hanover Trust Company complained that Hutton's corporate headquarters had overdrawn its national account by more than $1 billion, a sum vastly exceeding overdrafts in the branches over many months. Quote, all of that is authorized, Bell testified. Asked if it was authorized by the bank, he replied, quote, no, authorized in the Hutton establishment. Okay, so first off, we have the rather interesting case of Griffin Bell, former Attorney General of the United States, being hired by E.F. Hutton to probe its illegal cash management practices, who managed to leave out the Washington branch entirely. We noticed that at least one end of the pizza connection originated in, well, at least the American side of it originated in Washington and Virginia. We also know Griffin Bell being accused by some of the people involved of having deliberately managed the probe to protect those high up in E.F. Hutton and to put the blame on lowly employees. Does this sound familiar to any of you out there? Does the name Oliver North mean anything to any of you out there?
Something that's worth thinking about in this context, of course, why was the Washington branch overlooked in this particular investigation, again, with the Washington connection to the pizza case, the Medellin connection to that Washington connection, it's worth thinking about, and with E.F. Hutton being one of the firms used to launder the Gambino New York pizza connection case. And again, Scott Pierce, George Bush's brother-in-law, George Bush's name cropping up in a lot of different contexts in connections with the Contra supplier for its drug connections. Something that's worth thinking about, too, in this regard is that, although obviously lawyers have a lot of cases, Griffin Bell was the attorney for Eugene Hasenfuss when he was shot down in the, quote, fat lady, that is to say the C-123 owned by Southern Air Transport and used by Barry Adler Seal in the Medellin sting. So we realize that that we're throwing out a lot of elements here, and that there's some of the connections are speculative. Again, the Iran-Contra case is just unfolding now, so it's an unfinished book in a sense. And one of the questions we're asking is what relationship does exist between some of these things which involve some of the same people and some of the same elements. And the EF, the oversight of the investigation into EF Hutton's Washington branch, EF Hutton's connection to the pizza connection case, the Medellin connection to the Washington pizza connection case, and the Contra connections to Medellin, that's basically what we're looking at here. While the New York pizza connection case, again, the heroin and to a lesser extent cocaine case, the Gambino pizza case, we could call it for the time being, was underway, and the Iran-Contra scandal was breaking, two defendants were murdered during the course of the investigation. We heard an allusion to those murders in the first article read about the New York pizza connection case. We're going to look more at those murders and some irregularities during the course of that prosecution as we go along. This is from the New York Times of Thursday, December 4th of 1986. It's by Todd S. Purdum, P-U-R-D-U-M, and it's called Police Pursuing Idea for Motive in Pizza Slaying. Detectives investigating the murder of a defendant in the Pizza Connection drug trial are leaning toward the theory that he was killed because he was preparing to cooperate with prosecutors, law enforcement officials said yesterday. Again, the theory concerning the murder of Gaetano Mazzara is that he was going to cooperate with the authorities. The body of the defendant, Gaetano Mazzara, who was accused of being a heroin supplier and member of the Sicilian Mafia, was found in a garbage bag on a Brooklyn street Tuesday morning, 5 days after his family had reported him missing. Mr. Mazzara, a 51-year-old former restaurant owner from Sayreville, New Jersey, had been on trial in federal district court in Manhattan, along with 19 other defendants accused of operating a major ring that distributed drugs and money and hid its operations behind a network of pizza restaurants. The police initially reported that Mr. Mazzara had sharp gashes in the back of his head and above his right eye that might have been made with an axe or cleaver. Yesterday, they said preliminary autopsy results had also found two .22 caliber slugs in the victim's head, but that the precise cause of death had not been determined. Skipping down, law enforcement officials, meanwhile, said Mr. Mazzara, who was last seen at a bakery in Sayreville the day before Thanksgiving, may have known an Italian national who was found shot to death in a car in Broad Channel, Queens, last Saturday night. The officials said the victim in that case, Francesco Caruso, 39, was a courier who transported drugs between the United States and Europe. They said there was no indication that murders were linked, but said it was possible the two men had moved in the same circle. So as we saw, as was the case with the Medellin investigation and the Contra drug effort per se, a lot of people begin dropping dead when the Pizza Connection case comes to trial. We've taken a look at the resignations of the firing of Donald Regan as White House Chief of Staff, the resignation of Scott Pierce from E.F. Hutton at this same time.
Another casualty, perhaps, almost definitely, of the Pizza Connection case, but perhaps a casualty in the larger sense of the Contragate investigation, we're still not sure. A man by the name of Pietro Alfano. We're going to read a short article in which the events that that put him on the casualty list are described from the San Jose Mercury News of Thursday, February 12th of this year. The article is headlined, Gunman Shoot Defendant in Organized Crime Trial. I don't believe his name is mentioned, so I will tell you the man in question here is named Pietro Alfano. Dateline New York, an AP Wire story. A pair of gunmen shot and wounded two men, one a defendant in the pizza connection organized crime trial, the other a bystander, on a busy Manhattan street Wednesday in what police called a hit. The gunmen opened fire in front of the Black Rock Cafe in Greenwich Village about 5 p.m. and ran from the scene, with one jumping into a waiting van and the other into a waiting cab, said Chief of Detectives Robert Colangelo. It was the second recent attack on defendants in the trial. Another defendant, again Gaetano Mazzara, Dave just spoke about, another defendant was found slain in a garbage bag in an industrial section of Brooklyn in December with $700 in cash still in his pockets. Again, here, the bystander was apparently just that, an innocent bystander, but the man shot who was a defendant in the Pizza Connection case, a man by the name of Pietro Alfano, himself was one of the owners of one of the Pizza Connection restaurants used in this particular operation.
And not only were some of the defendants attacked and apparently murdered, well, not apparently murdered, certainly murdered, the motives remain
definitely
a matter of
dead.
Speculation.
Definitely dead.
And remember, one of them was also quite possibly connected to an Italian national and drug courier who was found murdered, but a juror in the pizza trial was threatened and removed because of that death threat while the trial was in progress. Reading now from the New York Times of Saturday, February 28th of 1987. This is an article headlined, "Juror in Pizza Trial Removed from Case After Phone Threat." A juror in the Pizza Connection drug trial in Manhattan was removed from the deliberations yesterday because a member of her family received an apparently threatening telephone call. Judge Pierre M. Laval ordered the deliberations to resume with 11 jurors in the 17-month-old trial in Federal District Court in Manhattan. The deliberations began Wednesday afternoon and adjourned last night. All the jurors, whose names have been kept secret to protect them from any interference, have been sequestered in the care of federal marshals since the shooting of a defendant, Pietro Alfano, on February 11th. The jurors are permitted to talk to their families in telephone calls that are monitored by the marshals. In a call on Thursday evening, a juror's family told her about receiving a vague threat from an unidentified caller, according to lawyers in the trial. Judge Laval, who was informed of the incident, questioned the juror privately and then excused her from the deliberations, although the juror said she did not associate the call with the trial and was prepared to continue deliberating. Federal prosecutors asked the judge to remove the juror and go forward with an 11-member jury without inserting one of three available alternate jurors. Defense lawyers objected, seeking to retain the juror or replace her with an alternate. While arguments over the unusual issue continued in the judge's robing room, the deliberations were delayed during the morning. They resumed with the remaining 11 jurors. So note the deaths and irregularities in the Pizza Connection case, and what we're asking here, and obviously we don't have the final answers, is there any connection between those and the Washington Pizza Connection case, the Medellin case, the one which obviously intersects with some of the drug smuggling networks involved with the Contra supply effort.
Now we're going to read about one of the interesting changes that has taken place within the Pizza Connection network itself since this case has begun to come to light and since some of the first indictments have been made. This is an article from the New York Times for Saturday, February 14th of this year. The article is headlined, "Split is Seen in Sicilian Mob Alliance." The article is by Ralph Blumenthal. And we're going to see a couple of rather interesting names here for longtime One Step Beyond listeners. We're going to hear a couple of names, I guess. You can't see names if you're a listener. Anyway, the article is by Ralph Blumenthal of the New York Times. What federal prosecutors have charged was a Sicilian mafia ring that smuggled nearly a ton of heroin and cocaine into the United States is increasingly splitting into two warring factions, according to investigators and lawyers. They say a collaboration between the factions has crumbled under the pressure of conflicting testimony and summations, as the grueling 16-month-old, quote, Pizza Connection trial winds to a close in federal court in Manhattan. The two factions might also have been caught in other underworld rivalries, experts say. One of the factions, according to trial testimony, is headed by Gaetano Badalamenti, a 63-year-old exiled former boss of the Sicilian Mafia's ruling commission. Federal prosecutors say his group supplied heroin to other factions, a group of Sicilians in New York headed by Salvatore Catalano, age 46. The authorities say he is a leader of the Bonanno crime family in New York City. In wiretap telephone conversations played in red at the trial, Mr. Badalamenti was heard issuing orders from a Brazilian hideout to relatives, who then dealt with associates of Mr. Catalano. Federal law enforcement officials said the dispute may have been a factor in the shooting Wednesday of one of the defendants, Pietro Alfano, a nephew of Mr. Badalamenti. Prosecutors say he acted as his uncle's liaison with a New York group. Three men charged in the shooting have been arrested, but the authorities were still lacking a motive for the attack. Mr. Alfano, a 51-year-old Illinois pizza maker, survived the shooting on the Avenue of the Americas in Greenwich Village, but remains in critical condition. Last Thanksgiving, another defendant, Gaetano Mazzara, considered a part of the Catalano faction, disappeared after apparently driving into Manhattan. His body was found on December 2nd, beaten and shot and wrapped in a plastic garbage bag on a Brooklyn street. The slaying remains unsolved. Skipping down later in the article, according to early trial testimony by a top-ranked Sicilian mafia turncoat, Tommaso Buscetta, mafia members were forbidden to engage in dealings with expelled members such as Mr. Badalamenti. Mr. Kennedy has contended that Mr. Badalamenti was ousted as head of the Sicilian Mafia Commission in 1976 because he supposedly opposed drug trafficking. Kennedy is Badalamenti's lawyer, I believe. Yeah, he is, Michael Kennedy. Anyway, the key name here, well, one of the key names here, is Tommaso Buscetta, spelled B-U-S-C-E-T-T-A. Tommaso Buscetta is a rather intriguing character who, among other things, is probably familiar to those of you who spent the time to listen to, either on tape or live, listen to the Guns of November, not the Guns of November series, the Mediterranean Merry-Go-Round series, otherwise known as Who Shot the Pope? Tommaso Buscetta is an interesting character.
Also known as Radio Free America shows 17 through 21, in particular numbers 18 and 19, we dealt with, although not at great length, the name Tommaso Buscetta. Now, one of the things that we've stated in our One Step Beyond shows concerning the Iran-Contra scandal is that the actual arms sale to Iran itself is probably the least important aspect of the entire case. What's really important is the information that would come to light if this team can be fully exposed, the secret team, as the Christic Institute people have referred to them. One of the elements which may very well come out in this entire connection, and one of the reasons why the pizza connection case is so explosive, concerns the fact that Tommaso Buscetta is an associate, an organized crime associate of Michele Sindona. Sindona, in turn, intersects with the Gambino brothers, one of the organized crime families behind the pizza connection case. And as we've seen, there may very well be one pizza connection case, not two. The Medellin, Washington pizza case may very well hook up with the other. Concerning Tommaso Buscetta and the Auguste Ricord drug smuggling network, which we looked at in Radio Free America number 27, it eventually provided the basis for Klaus Barbie's cocaine operation that we looked at. Anyway, in describing the relationship between Michele Sindona, Tommaso Buscetta, the Ricord network, and the Gambino brothers, we're going to fall back on a book called The Great Heroin Coup. That's authored by freelance Danish journalist Henrik Kruger, K-R-U-G-E-R, forwarded by University of California at Berkeley professor Peter Dale Scott, published in 1980, or copyright 1980, published in softcover by the South End Press. Of the Buscetta-Sindona-Gambino-Ricord link here, Kruger writes as follows. Rosario and Giuseppe Gambino, who federal law enforcement officials say ran 200 southern New Jersey pizza joints employing illegal aliens, had allegedly masterminded the smuggling of 90 pounds of heroin from Afghanistan, Iran, and Pakistan by way of Milan, Italy. What makes their case all the more intriguing is the Gambino's connection to the powerful Milan-based financier Michele Sindona. Sindona was convicted in New York in late March on counts ranging from bank fraud to perjury after looting $45 million from the Franklin National Bank, America's 20th largest, which he controlled and brought to ruin. In June, a New York judge sentenced him to 25 years imprisonment, a record for white-collar crime. He is similarly accused of looting $225 million from his banks in Milan. On the 2nd of August, 1979, 3 weeks after the assassination in Milan of the lawyer chosen to liquidate Sindona's bankrupt Banca Privata Italiana, and 1 month before the scheduled opening of his New York trial, Sindona disappeared, supposedly kidnapped by left-wing Italian extremists, as he later reported, only to reappear 2.5 months later on 42nd Street and 10th Avenue with a bullet wound in his thigh and with documents miraculously gathered during his abduction in Europe, which he claimed would exonerate him. That was not all. On January 24, 1980, it was announced that three high-standing clerics from the Vatican, whose immense financial holdings had once been in Sindona's hands, were going to be his character witnesses, an offer the Vatican would later retract. Sindona's fortune suffered another setback, however, when Italian and U.S. agents established that he had arranged his own disappearing act, booking, for example, his own European flights, and that his accomplices had included the Gambino brothers. The Gambinos, it seems, had a long record in the import, export, and protection of criminals and other illegal aliens, among them the family of Sicilian mafia chieftain Tomasa Buccetta, who, recall, was dispatched to South America to take over the Record network, but wound up joining Christian David's heroin connection. So again, the Buccetta connection to the Gambinos and to Michele Sindona is worth bearing in mind here. He was a key witness in the Pizza Connection case, and the Pizza Connection case, as we've seen, may very well dovetail with the Washington Pizza Connection case, which dovetails with Medellin and the Contra Supply drug connections.
Now, while you're thinking about all those dovetails, we got more dovetails there than we got in a passenger pigeon network. We got a lot of them. While you're thinking about that, we're going to take a short musical break for a few more minutes, and then we're going to be back with the last segment of information for tonight. We're going to be finishing up tonight's broadcast. So the road theme music signifies that Dave Emery and myself, Nip Tuck, have returned for the final, the home stretch, as it were, of Radio Free America. Number 29, our first of a three-part series on the Iran/Contragate hearings. I hate it when people say Iran and Iran. Iran/Contragate hearings. And tonight's special, particularly focusing on the drug aspect and the drug trade that has been so absolutely significant and, in fact, seems to be one of the underpinnings of the Iran-Contragate scandal, as it were, although to this point none of the real scandalous stuff has been exposed in the public forum.
And it may have something to do with all the corpses that we've been reporting.
Yeah, it could have something to do with that indeed. To the several in our newfound One Step Beyond / Radio Free America jargon, to the KDPs, the key dead players who keep turning up dead. And what we're going to do now for the last part of the broadcast is, among other things, we're going to focus heavily on the Christic Institute affidavit, which goes over and sort of codifies a lot of the things that we have been talking about over time. So as Dave and I were discussing during the break, we may not do quite as much extrapolation as we usually do, because a lot of this stuff is very familiar to One Step Beyond listeners.
What we're going to be doing now is going through a good section of the chronology of the Christic Institute's the Daniel Sheehan affidavit, pursuant to and part of the Christic Institute suit filed on behalf of Tony Abrigan and Martha Honey. Now, in Radio Free, our five-part series on the involvement of the U.S. intelligence agencies with narcotics, much of the information, in fact, the vast bulk of the information we're about to report to you is covered. So in terms of the background on the Cuban-American mafia, their involvement with the anti-Castro efforts of CIA and drug trafficking, we would refer you to Radio Free America shows 26 and 27 in particular, with regard to the origins of the U.S. involvement with narcotic smuggling and the Southeast Asian connections. We refer you to Radio Free America show number 24, the first of our five-part series on the narcotics agent, the intelligence agencies and narcotics. Sometimes the two are easily confused. In fact, the two obviously operate together. And for background on the Nugenhand Bank and the Guns for Drugs scandal that figures obviously so prominently in this, Radio Free America number 25. And I would say we'll be coming back to some of these drug connections in the next program, too, because the drug and terror connections are heavily intertwined.
All right, you're going to see numerous references to sources. These, in fact, are sources interviewed by the Christic Institute for the purpose of compiling this particular affidavit.
Once again, for background, for extrapolation on some of the information presented here, we refer you to the aforementioned Radio Free America shows, because there are going to be a lot of names here, a lot of facts, and we're not going to take the time here to go over all of them in the kind of detail we might. We've already, we believe, done this. This is by way of tying in the networks that we're looking now with the information presented on our previous Radio Free America shows on the subject of the U.S. intelligence agencies and their involvement in the narcotics traffic.
Okay, reading from the Daniel Sheehan affidavit on behalf of the Christic Institute suit, itself on behalf of journalists Tony Abrigan and Martha Honey. The first Contra war, in quotes, organized crime and right-wing terror politics. Sources 48 and 49 described above, as well as sources number 67 and 68, who are tenured professors at accredited universities in the U.S., who conduct professional research into government documents, interview persons in the U.S. intelligence community, and teach accredited courses regarding the history of the activities of our American intelligence community, as well as source number 69, who was a retired official of the United States Customs Department and Federal Bureau of Narcotics and Dangerous Drugs, and source 70, who was a former Southeast Asian border police officer, source 71, who was a retired CIA official. All have communicated evidence to plaintiff's counsel which constitutes probable cause to believe that the following facts are true regarding the defendants in this case. That, in late 1959, immediately after Fidel Castro drove dictator Batista out of Cuba, former United States Vice President Richard M. Nixon established and chaired a special committee within the United States National Security Council with the express assignment of developing and executing a plan by means of which to mount a covert, quote, contra war against the socialist government of Cuba, utilizing expatriate indigenous right-wing Cubans who had been loyal to dictator Batista. The objective of this non-congressionally authorized operation was to undermine, weaken, and eventually overthrow the revolutionary socialist government of Cuba. It appears that this secret operation was then codenamed Operation 40. That in late 1959, then Vice President Richard M. Nixon, with the direct participation and cooperation of United States Central Intelligence Agency Director Alan Dulles, undertook the supervision of the recruiting of expatriate right-wing Cubans who had fled from Cuba to Miami, Florida, and caused to be established two secret military training bases for their, quote, contra forces, one south of Miami, Florida, and one in Guatemala. CIA Director Alan Dulles assigned CIA agent and former Marine Corps officer Carl Jenkins to supervise the training of these, quote, contra forces in guerrilla warfare tactics in Florida and Guatemala. The objective of this Nixon-Dulles-supervised operation was to train and to secretly infiltrate these expatriate Cubans back into Cuba, where they would set up centers of guerrilla military resistance to the Castro-led socialist government. These forces would also mount terrorist military attacks against the economic infrastructure of Cuba, making it difficult for the new revolutionary government to organize and operate the economy. With this covert NSC-CIA program underway in early 1960, then Vice President Richard M. Nixon secretly, quote, reached out, unquote, to one Robert Mayhew, spelled M-A-H-E-U, although they don't spell it right here in the affidavit, the chief of staff and de facto director of billionaire Howard Hughes' empire in Las Vegas, Nevada. Only Richard Nixon and President Eisenhower knew that Howard Hughes, through Mayhew, was secretly bankrolling a totally non-congressionally authorized, super-secret program involving the deep-sea operations of the ship Glomar Explorer, the secret project then being codenamed Operation Desktop. Because of Mayhew's super-secret status, known only to Richard Nixon and President Eisenhower, Richard Nixon selected Mayhew to attend an equally secret meeting in early 1960 in Florida, with two men representing former Havana Mafia don Santo Traficante, whose fabulously wealthy Havana casino, hotel, and prostitution operation run by Resorts International, Inc., a Meyer Lansky Mafia company, had been driven out of Cuba, along with Traficante's business associate Batista, in 1959.
Continuing with the affidavit. At this early 1960 Florida meeting between Robert Mayhew, representing Richard Nixon, and John Roselli and Sam Giancana, representing Meyer Lansky Mafia Lieutenant Santos Traficante, it was agreed between Richard Nixon and Santo Traficante that the NSC's secret Operation 40 would be secretly supplemented by secreting within this operation a private, quote-unquote, sub-operation, which was to be supervised directly by the Mafia's Havana Lieutenant Santos Traficante. This secret private unit, unquote, was to be a political assassination unit assigned to murder Cuban President Fidel Castro, his brother Raul Castro, Che Guevara, and five other revolutionary Cuban government leaders. Former associates of Cuban dictator Batista and of Resorts International boss Santo Traficante were, according to this early 1960 Nixon-Traficante agreement, to be selected out of the Operation 40 participants by Santo Traficante and then secretly trained as political assassins by Traficante and his mafia associates at a secret triangular fire training base to be located in Mexico. Those selected from Operation 40 by Santo Traficante to become members of the shooter team, unquote, were Rafael Chichi Quintero, Felix Rodriguez, a.k.a. Max Gomez, we referred to him earlier, Luis Posada Carrillo, a.k.a. Ramon Medina, Rafael Villaverde, Raul Villaverde, Ricardo Chavez, Frank Fiorini, a.k.a. Frank Sturgis, Rolando Martinez, and two other Cuban Americans. I would interrupt here that, of course, Rodriguez is Max Gomez that we've been looking at. We're going to come back to Posada Carrillo. Raul and Rafael Villaverde we looked at in connection with our program on Turple and Wilson. We did the same with Chichi Quintero. Frank Sturgis, of course, we've looked at many times, including Guns of November. Rolando Martinez, along with Frank Sturgis, was one of the Watergate burglars.
Just because these names get so complicated, I think that that's another error in the typing of the affidavit. I think it's Posada Carriles.
Yeah, C-A-R-I-L-L-E-S.
Right.
Continuing with the affidavit. One of the supervisors of the group was to be E. Howard Hunt, codenamed Eduardo. This secret shooter team began training in early 1960. When John F. Kennedy received the Democratic Party nomination for president in the summer of 1960, he was briefed by a CIA officer about the existence of Operation 40 and its objectives, but it does not appear that either he or Robert Kennedy were ever briefed about the existence of the shooter team. However, the shooter team continued to train, and indeed, between 1960 and 63, initiated several efforts to assassinate Cuban President Fidel Castro. Between January of 1961 and April of 1961, the low-profile guerrilla infiltration strategy of Operation 40 was transmuted in a plan for a full-scale military invasion of Cuba to be staged at the now infamous Bay of Pigs. This invasion, using the personnel of Operation 40, failed disastrously in April of 1961. However, by June of 1961, Robert Kennedy had regrouped the tattered remnants of the old Operation 40 forces and reinitiated the old, lower-profile strategy of infiltration and guerrilla raid into Cuba. This reborn Operations 40 was named Operation Mongoose. This covert Contra war was secretly prosecuted by the Kennedy administration from June of 61 to November of 1963. The supervisor of Operation Mongoose was then 34 years old, Theodore Shackley. His deputy was Thomas Clines. This operation, functioning in a working partnership with Mafia Lieutenant Santos Traficante, operated from a base located in a few buildings on the campus of the University of Miami. This base, and the operation itself, came to be called JM Wave. These Contra war operations and their associated Traficante-led political assassination sub-operation were directed by Theodore Shackley and Thomas Clines from 1961 to 1963. Of course, Shackley and Clines, two of the key players in the Triple Wilson team that we went over in RFA number four, they're key players in the Iran-Contra scandal. We'll be talking a lot more about them later in this broadcast and in programs to come.